As I start the last two most relevant results you can find on this section are the following. Both these results regards the connection that can be established between Jacobi and the outsider methods. Probably you know that in general every possible situation about the convergence of these two methods, every possible situation can occur. That is, we have no convergence for both, convergence for both, the first converges, the second no, and vice versa. Even if one has the sensation that for the way in which Jacobi and Gauss Seidel are defined, it should be preferable to use Gauss Seidel, since in the iterations Gauss Seidel uses the all the possible information about deriving from the previous computations. There are two famous theorems which give a light about this problem, the connection between the two methods. These two theorems allows to see two cases in some information, some detailed, more detailed information about their convergence can be given. The first is the so-called Stein-Rosenberg theorem. Here we find only the statement, the proof is quite complicated, which applies to a matrix, a coefficient matrix with the main entries non-zero, and such that J is the Jacobi iteration matrix, such that J has non-negative entries. These are the assumptions. Remember that in general, J, the Jacobi iteration matrix, must have zeros along the main diagonal. The other entries have the form minus A sub ij over A sub ii. This number in this theorem, in the assumptions required by this theorem, must be non-negative. If this happens, then we must be in one of these cases. one of the following cases must occur. Four cases. Both the spectral radius radii of G and of J, the two iteration matrices, are zero. Or both converges, both converge with Gauss Seidel having a faster speed. You know that the spectral radius of the matrix of iteration matrix measures can be taken as a measure of the speed of convergence. We could define, we don't do this, but we could define a rate of convergence depending on these spectral radii. Both converge and the outside is better. The third case is they are both equal to one, no convergence. The last case, we have no convergence, and the spectral radius of Gauss Seidel is larger than the spectral radius of J. So we have a full framework of the possible situation. This is not true in general. We need this condition and this other condition. This is a strong result. That put some order in a general confused case. An elegant result of this type regards an important class of matrices, the tri-diagonal matrices. So, we start from a three-diagonal coefficient matrix A, only with the assumption in this case that the main entries are non-zero. The result is this. If mu is eigenvalue of J, then its square, mu squared, is eigenvalue of G. If lambda is eigenvalue of G, then the square root of lambda are eigen values of J, all the square roots. So, in a few words,
this result states that rho of G is equal
to the square of rho of J.
So
this result is similar in some sense to the previous. Also in this case we see that there is a strong connection between the behaviors of the two methods. And also in this case we see that if convergence occurs, Gauss-Seidel is faster. These are two numbers less than one, so we have convergence for both methods, but Gauss-Seidel has a faster convergence, gives a faster convergence. The proof, we read the proof, which is not very complicated. The proof uses some Bessler facts. And a preliminary trick. There is this transformation which we can perform over the matrix J. First we call in some way the entries of A. The entries of A, which is 3 that we have now, alpha sub 1 sub n, no, A. A, not alpha, A. C sub 1 sub n minus 1 for the super diagonal, and B sub I for the sub diagonal. If A is made in this way, you know that the matrix J is 0 entries along the main diagonal because it is necessary for the definition. 0 in the positions where are these zeros. The two diagonals adjacent to the main diagonal in J are here entries of the 4 minus C with the right index sub some A. A with the right index, the index that in this position is 1. Here is minus B 1 over A sub 1, sub 2, 0. Here you have minus C sub 2 over A sub 2, and so on. The last on this side is minus B sub. Minus 1 over A sub n, and C minus sub n minus 1 over A sub n minus 1. The trick that we use is the following. Suppose to consider, let us consider matrix, a diagonal matrix. Its name is S because it's a scaling matrix. Made with the powers of an arbitrary parameter alpha the powers from 0 up to n minus 1. We need only that alpha is different from 0. If you consider the similarity transformation S by J by the inverse of S, that is, you made a scaling, or better, a balancing of the matrix S by J by the inverse of S. These products, this product has the, these two products have the effect of, on the left, to multiply the rows of J by this number, and on the right, to divide the columns of J by this number. So, on the main diagonal, nothing changes, besides the fact that on the main diagonal there are zero elements. While all the adjacent diagonals, we have just a scaling effect of this type. Again, zero along the main diagonal, and I see the I write the generic entries on the super diagonal, which has the form minus C with the right index divided by alpha by A with the same index. So the same entries as before divided by alpha. On the other side, on the sub-diagonal, we have the same entries, B sub I, say, divided by A with the index increased by 1, A sub I plus 1. This term is multiplied by alpha. Here is divided, here is multiplied. So the effect of this particular similarity transformation, a balancing, as sometimes it is called, is to obtain a matrix that can be expressed as the subdiagonal alpha, all the terms are multiplied by alpha, and the previous subdiagonal, that is the diagonal of D multiplied by the subdiagonal, that is B, plus the same thing with alpha at the denominator, 1 over alpha, the inverse of B on the same side, by C. C is the supper, the opposite of the supper diagonal of A. This is a similarity transformation. So the eigenvalues of this matrix are the same as the eigenvalues are the same as the eigenvalues of J. Same I can correctly consider the characteristic polynomial of this matrix instead of the characteristic polynomial of J. Characteristic polynomial, which means that of Sj, the inverse of S,
minus
the eigenvalues of J are called
attitude alpha and add
the term
with the identity matrix minus mu by I. I want to
bring outside the brackets
one over alpha.
I can do this. So I have alpha squared can do this because alpha of TV is different from zero. If mu is an eigenvalue of J, the characteristic polynomial annihilates. Its value is zero, but the determinant of this matrix is zero if and only if the determinant of the matrix inside the brackets is zero. So I can omit this factor and consider simply what is left, that is this matrix. This equation holds for all values of alpha different from zero. The idea is to consider alpha equal to mu. Mu can be zero, however. But if mu is zero, if we consider correctly the possibility that the matrix J has a zero eigenvalues, we observe that anyway G has always the eigenvalues zero. You must remember that we have not recalled this fact, it's a simple fact. The matrix G of Gauss-Seidel has always the first column equal to the zero vector. G must be made in this way. Here, there must be all zeros. So, G has always zero as eigenvalue. So the statement of the theorem we are proving is correct in the case that the eigenvalues mu is zero. We consider so only the eigenvalues of J, the eigenvalues mu, that are different from zero. We assign to alpha these values and we have and we have this equation. We leave this equation on the board, and we turn to the eigenvalues of G. Remember what we want to prove. We want to prove that the first statement. The square of mu is also eigenvalue of G. Well, to prove this, we have found that mu squared satisfies this equation. So we will find that the polynomial, the characteristic polynomial of G, can be written exactly in this way. In fact, consider the matrix G minus lambda I. The definition of G the usual definition of G minus lambda I forced to appear as a factor on the left the inverse of D minus B. C is left minus lambda D minus B. The first inverse can be rewritten, I left only the last row on the board. The first inverse can be rewritten with the matrix D as a factor outside the bracket. I mean, matrix D minus B can be written, D is invertible, as D multiplied by I minus the inverse of D by B. The inverse of this is therefore this matrix. So we continue with the expression, substitute and find A minus this matrix inverted D minus 1. Put D minus 1 inside the square brackets. Minus lambda by E, right? V minus 1 by D makes I plus lambda D minus 1 by V. And we have finally found the characteristic equation. This was the characteristic equation if we consider the determinant. This was the matrix G minus lambda by I. It's determinant, characteristic polynomial, characteristic equation, determinant equal to zero. I cancel this term, that is the determinant of what? This matrix is left and we find, let me see if it is correct, the same matrix D minus 1 by C, D minus 1 by C, the matrix I. Here it was multiplied by the square of mu, here it is multiplied by lambda. And the third matrix, lambda, D minus 1 by B, mu squared D minus 1 by B. we have found the same matrix, the determinant of the same matrix, with the, only the difference that here we had the square of an eigenvalue of J, and here we have an eigenvalue of lambda. So both the statements are proven by this fact. If mu is eigenvalue of J, lambda equal to mu squared is eigenvalue of G, and I don't write it again. The other assertion in the other sense, if I have lambda and eigenvalue of G, all the number, the complex number mu, which are the square roots of lambda, are eigenvalue of G. So in this case, we are sure that if we can choose, we have to choose between Jacobi, and Gauss-Seidel. We see that Gauss-Seidel is faster, and we have the exact measure of the improvement of the rate of convergence. That's all for today and for the iterative methods for linear systems. There is another important, most recent technologies, I could say, about this kind of problem, were obtained by the introduction of the conjugate gradient methods about 30 or 40 years ago. So the first week of December we consider the conjugate gradient methods, which has also a version for optimization. So we'll see the same method used in a slightly different ways in the two contexts of in two kinds of applications, both for the resolution of numerical resolution of linear systems, and also for problems of optimization, also in the non-linear case. That's all. Thank you for today.